please have a seat. I will open the Subcommittee on Natural Resources for Tuesday, June 19th, 2007. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3525 relating to Columbia River Water. Call.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, there's a number of materials at your place, including some written testimony. Written testimony also from the Department of Water Resources Department, Department of Fish and Wildlife. There's a letter from the Governor's Natural Resource Advisor, Mike Carrier, expressing concerns the Governor has with House Bill 3525, and a letter from the Governor addressed to the Senate President and Speaker of the House. The second paragraph is the pertinent section. Many ideas have surfaced on ways to develop new sources of water, and I am lending my support to a number of them. However, the Oasis Project, as proposed in Senate Bill 483 and House Bill 3525, is not an approach I can support.
This morning, we will be going through a hearing process where we will have a panel in favor of the measure before us, a panel opposed, and then we'll be going back and forth between in favor and opposed to the extent that we can. I see I have two representatives here. Would you both like to speak, Representative Jensen and Representative Witt?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be opposed to this, so I will be on the second panel.
Okay. You could go ahead. The panels have been previously set up. Are you supposed to be part of the panel, or?
I'd be happy to go as a
Representative leader. Jensen, would you like to say some words also?
Yes.
Oh, please come forward.
Mr. Chair?
Okay.
Just while Representative Jensen's coming up, I was just curious of the chair as to why this bill did not have a work session scheduled.
Representative Garrard, as I think you've been in the process almost as long as I have, those decisions are made a tier above me.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Representative Bob Jensen, House District 58, which includes most of Umatilla County, and a small, very small sliver of Union County that does include some acreage, but to date I have yet to find a registered voter in that acreage. But be that as it may, I'm here to thank the chair of the committee and the committee for hearing House Bill 3525 today, and I'm also here to request that the chair of the committee have a work session on this bill, and I have heard the words that the chair has already made on that and understand them completely and fully, but it is still my duty and obligation to the citizens of the state of Oregon, as well as the constituents that I represent, to make that request. I'm not going to at this particular time make any statements. I'm just encouraging you. I know you have panels of folks that are going to be presenting material here, and I'm not going to take their time or waste your time. At this particular point, they have more important things to say and will be able to say them more eloquently probably than I can, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee might have of me.
Any questions for Representative Jensen? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for your patience and for your thoughtful consideration of House Bill 3525 today.
Thank you very much. Representative Witt. And I did not plan this as my first panel in favor and opposed.
Thank you.
If you would please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31, appearing today in opposition of House Bill 3525, not because We know that this is a bad bill, and it's certainly not because we know it's a good bill, but it's simply because we don't know what kind of bill this is or what kind of impacts it will have on the Columbia River ecosystem, because largely I don't think the necessary preparatory homework has been done, and specifically a study to demonstrate whether, in fact, this would be impact neutral. The proponents have come up with an idea, essentially to make the desert bloom. Sounds like a wonderful idea, but they haven't provided the scientific certainty to those of us who live downriver from this proposed project to know whether, in fact, taking 500,000 acre-feet of water per year from the Columbia River is going to be an okay thing to do ecologically. Which is to say that nobody has taken the time to do a peer-reviewed scientific report. And that is principally, Mr. Chairman, what I'm interested in seeing happen, to make the assurance that we will do no harm, particularly in light of all of the salmon recovery efforts that our state has undertaken. The fact that no one has done the report, no one has come to me as the representative of what is called the River District to ask me what I see as problems, to ask me what I and or my constituents think would be mitigating efforts to overcome any potential problems. The fact that none of this has happened to date suggests to me that this is a water grab. And if that is what it is, Mr. Chairman, I have to tell you that I and a great number, and I think you're going to be hearing from several of them, of my constituents, are going to oppose this project. We have spent vastly too much time, effort, energy, resources as a state, our government, our citizens, and our businesses in the recovery of salmon to ever allow a new group of users to undermine our efforts in salmon recovery. We have lost too many jobs. We have spent too much money. We have set aside vastly too much production. We have planned, and replanned for salmon recovery. We have attempted mitigation effort after mitigation effort. We have given up many recreational, commercial, and industrial opportunities, all in an effort to save salmon, and we don't, again, want to see these efforts undermined. Commercial and sport fishermen, processors, tourism, recreationalists, the tribes, other states, municipalities, environmentalists, heavy industry, light industry, agriculture, longshoremen, forestry, and on and on and on, have all given up, have all lost opportunities in the name of saving salmon. It has been the right thing to do, but as I have said repeatedly here in my testimony, we do not intend to go backwards. We do not intend to see these efforts undermined. And, Mr. Chairman, there are ways to go about this to make sure that if this project were to move ahead, that it would not adversely impact any of my constituents or any of the efforts that the industry, environmentalists, the state have undertaken to this point. Unfortunately, that homework and that background has not been laid at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Representative. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. We will now go to our first, the chair requested actually two panels, but Mr. DiLorenzo, you're the first panel. You are
the panel soul.
Yes. And we'll have 10 minutes, and so will the opposition in their panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a partner with the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine and am here on behalf of my clients, the Umatilla Electric Cooperative and also the Oregon Oasis Project. We are here to not talk about the main bill, which has already been fairly thoroughly vetted in the House Environment Committee and also in the Senate Business Committee, but to talk more particularly about the Dash 4 amendments which we have proposed, which have been reprinted completely in Senate Bill 610, which is Senator Nelson's priority bill. And so I'm going to be confining my testimony today to a slimmed down version of the Oregon Oasis Project, which we have proposed largely in response to many of the concerns that have been voiced by the governor. Members, over the past decade, groundwater levels in eastern Oregon, and in particular in Umatilla County, have declined and severe restrictions have been implemented by the state, including curtailing water use from some wells and absolutely shutting off water use from others. All of this has been economically devastating to the region. Due to reduced groundwater allocations by the state, farmers, unable to rely upon an adequate supply of water, have planted low-value crops that do not require much water, or in many cases are allowing their otherwise rich farmland to sit idle. Given the declining groundwater aquifer levels, the Oregon Water Resources Department has severely limited withdrawals from some wells again and has shut off other wells within Stage Gulch, Butter Creek, and Ordnance critical groundwater areas. In all, approximately 65,000 acres in eastern Oregon are so affected and are virtually sitting fallow. One such affected tract is owned by Lloyd and Lois Piercy. The Piercys own and operate the Golden Canyon Ranch on Stage Gulch Road in the Echo Junction area. The ranch has water rights to irrigate 2,289 acres. Last winter, the Oregon Water Resources Department notified Mr. and Mrs. Piercy that it would drastically curtail their irrigated water usage due to critical groundwater. The agency cut off one permit and cut another from 11,000 acre feet down to 692 acre feet. Mr. Piercy was quoted in the Eastern Oregonian newspaper as follows. He said, quote, "The first thing I did was lay off three people, and my summer crew will be diminished significantly," unquote. To meet new water demand, Piercy also had to plow under an irrigated grass crop and replace it with dry land wheat. He said, quote, "It took all winter to plow under, and the worst part is I have to make an irrigated mortgage payment with a dry land wheat farm." Members, the situation faced by Piercy is illustrative of that faced by many eastern Oregon farmers. These farmers risk the loss of their investments and their livelihood. The state of Oregon, on the other hand, wastes the tremendous economic opportunities that could inure to that part of Oregon if only the smallest amount of water were made available for irrigation. Now, compared to Washington, Oregon uses very little water from the Columbia River, and we've distributed a chart for you that shows our revised bill. You see one side that's all brown, that shows the current state of affairs, and then you also see the back side showing the lush greenery that would result from adoption of this bill, and that shows the effects afterwards. And if you take a look at the first side, the current state of affairs, you'll notice that there's approximately 198 million acre feet of water that runs through the river, and of that flow, 93.07% ultimately reaches the ocean. The net irrigation withdrawals taken by all states from the Columbia River are only 6.93% of the total flow altogether. And of that 6.93%, Idaho takes 52.48%, Washington takes 32%, and Oregon uses 7.43% and has used approximately that sliver ever since Governor Barbara Roberts agreed that there would be no further withdrawals of water from the river. The Dash 4 amendments that we are proposing would make 195,000 acre feet of Columbia River water available for recharge or replacement, affecting these 65,000 acres. It would allow the water to be used for recharge or replenishment of the aquifers, or to be used directly in lieu of the critical groundwater to allow the aquifers to recharge. 5,000 acre feet per year would be used for municipal users. The Dash 4 amendments instruct Water Resources Department to issue permits to persons who can illustrate the means to be able to deliver the water from the river to their ultimate use on these 65,000 acres. The Oregon Oasis project was never designed to affect parity with our neighboring states. However, it will inch closer to parity, allowing some water to be used from the stem. The amount to be withdrawn will only increase the net irrigation withdrawals from 6.93% to 7.03%, and it will boost Oregon's percentage of overall withdrawal from 7.43% to 8.76%, still leaving Washington with 32% and Idaho with 51% of the total water use. The economic studies which we have conducted and submitted to the House Committee on Environment suggest that the crop values will add approximately $143 million to Oregon's economy. And this is because you can only get $500 per acre for dry land wheat. On the other hand, the prices that can be generated for peas are approximately $4,000 an acre, for sweet corn, $1,300 an acre, and for potatoes, up to $3,000 per acre. The economic impacts of adding a little bit of water to these acres is absolutely staggering. Now, during the course of our hearings, we reviewed the economic benefits, we reviewed the benefits for Oregon's biofuel initiative, we reviewed the clean air impacts, we did have an economic study, we also had a fish mortality study, which I will talk about in a second. But it's important to note, not one of those economic benefits were ever rebutted or even questioned by the opponents to the bill. The benefits were not questioned because, frankly, they are real and because they make common sense. And they are really unassailable. So why has there been opposition to the bill? The answer is simple. Our opponents have taken the position that this minuscule withdrawal of water envisioned by the main bill and reduced by three-fifths by these amendments will irreparably harm fish. Our opponents make these claims notwithstanding that they have produced not one model or study supporting that contention. Now, with all due respect to Representative Witt's position, my clients, on the other hand, utilized the same computer model relied upon by NOAA Fisheries, the COMPASS model, and they produced expert testimony from the director of the Columbia Basin Research within the School of Aquatic Fisheries and Sciences at the University of Washington. We retained that expert to model our program based upon the same NOAA Fisheries model, and that expert testimony, which is contained in your resource book, which was submitted to the House Environment Committee and also to the Senate Business Committee, makes it very clear that the withdrawals envisioned by the original bill will have absolutely no measurable or adverse impact on fish. All right, we have at least put forward a study that shows there is no adverse impact on fish. I think if you ask the governor's representatives or the water resources representatives or the fish and wildlife representatives, they would be hard-pressed to show that there would be any adverse impact. Rather, they will say we should be moving in the direction of helping fish. Any withdrawals, even an eyedropper, are too much. Now, at pages 5 and 10 of my testimony, I attempt to debunk some of the claims that have been made by the opposition. I won't review them here, but basically I talk about the lack of any federal impacts. I address the criticisms waged by Waterwatch and the criticisms waged by the Umatilla tribes, and I'm happy to answer questions about that. In conclusion, though, I would just like to say that the risks to salmon that are recovery that could be posed by the Dash 4 amendments are either unmeasurable or extremely low. These risks are more than offset by the sure economic benefits that will be occasioned by the Oregon Oasis Project. The vast economic benefits, including the numerous new jobs and the growth potential for rural communities, the contributions to our biofuels initiative, the benefits to clean air, and the recognition of Northwest Oregon as deserving economic growth are certainly worth that minimal risk. Every day we cross the street, we involve ourselves in a risk-reward analysis. I would suggest that the potential risks here are clearly outweighed by the rewards. Members, my clients have met at minimum their burden of persuasion. We have come forward with expert testimony. We have evaluated the fish impacts. We have evaluated the economic impacts. The burden should, at minimum, shift to our critics to show how the minor withdrawals envisioned by this plan will harm fish, or why the minor risks are not outweighed by the obvious beneficial economic, environmental, and social advantages which this project will bring to a very deserving region of our state. But our opponents have nothing. Nothing other than their beliefs that any drop of water might harm fish, all of which is not backed up by a single piece of science or a single study. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have a golden opportunity at hand. We really should do this. Thank you very much for your time and your courtesies. I'm available to answer any questions which you or members of the committee may have.
Okay. Committee members, we will have about 3 to 5 minutes for questions. Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Seeing that there's opposition from the federal government, the tribes, some state government, environmentalists, what would be the federal requirements that would affect the Oasis project?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, the federal requirements which would affect the project would only be triggered if any federal action were envisioned by the program. The Oasis Plan and the Dash 4 amendments to the plan basically require water resources to issue permits to those persons who can illustrate the means to deliver the water. The areas and the pumping stations from which the water can be delivered are listed in page 6 of my testimony. It is envisioned that the Oregon Oasis Project will utilize untapped resources and untapped demand on those particular pumping stations. There will be no need to expand pumping stations. There will be no need to lower the pumping stations. There will be no federal action required whatsoever. Because there will be no federal action required whatsoever, there would be no necessity for an environmental impact statement under NEPA. There would be no necessity for complying with any federal regulations unless changes would be required at those pumping stations. So there are none.
A follow-up, I mean, we talked about the Endangered Species Act. What about lawsuits takes under that particular?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, no one can avoid the filing of a lawsuit. Any plaintiff can file a lawsuit anytime they want, and normally, unless their theory is completely specious, they normally can do that without risk of an award of attorney's fees. And so to say that no lawsuits would ever be filed, I think, would be inaccurate. What I can say is that the state has little exposure from any of those lawsuits. One lawsuit or theory, which I have heard bantered about, would be whether or not there would be a violation of the Endangered Species Act. It's true that the Endangered Species Act will protect endangered species from any taking. However, in light of the current science, in light of the science as has been reviewed by the Independent Science Advisory Board for the remand parties, these withdrawals at their peak, 900 CFS, at peak times during August for irrigation, would not even have a measurable impact on fish. And although the standards for issuing an injunction under the ESA are quite liberal, the plaintiffs still must sustain the burden of proof. They must show that there would be some adverse impact on the species. And they can't show that. They can't measure it. So I'm not too concerned about any exposure to the state from an ESA lawsuit.
speaking about lawsuits, I mean, basically, your clients could file a lawsuit, too, from your point.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, that's correct. I have made it pretty clear to the governor's representatives that the frustration level among those who seek even an eyedropper full of water to irrigate their lands has come to a boiling point. In the past, those irrigators have been working very cooperatively with the tribes who have sought their own water rights for their own commercial purposes, their industrial parks, their golf courses, etc. But those days could very well be over if the irrigators are completely deprived of any opportunity for water. If that ever occurs, there would be lawsuits going the other way. I suggested when we were talking about the fiscal impacts that, sure, if the Oasis bill passes, someone might file a lawsuit, but those who try to estimate fiscal impacts should also consider what happens if the Oregon Oasis bill doesn't pass.
One last follow-up. Concerning the tribe has worked very diligently with some of the local folks out there, and they have some concerns with this bill.
Before we go to this question, we have time for that question and one from Representative Clem, and then we've got to go on to the next panel.
Talk about the situation with the tribes, because it's a pretty sensitive point from our community's viewpoint.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, first of all, we have great respect for the tribes. We have great respect for what they're doing economically, for what they're doing with their land, for their conservation practices. And so we don't mean to take an adversarial position with the tribes. The tribes have suggested that passage of the Oregon Oasis Plan will disrupt Phase 3 of the Umatilla Project. What they mean by that is their efforts to negotiate a federal water right and to have some resolution, finally, of their claims for water, both under the 1856 treaty and under their state rights. Our view is that there is absolutely nothing inconsistent with this plan and the tribe's goals. In fact, under the original version of House Bill 3525, the tribes themselves could have been applicants for water for economic use. We have no objection to that at all. In fact, we welcome it because we know that the tribes are a driving economic force in the region. What we want is economic and agricultural development. If the tribes have a project that can fill the bill, we want to be cooperative, and we find absolutely nothing inconsistent with these bills and the goals of the tribes.
Representative Clinton, and then we will have to go on to the next panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And John, if there's someone else more appropriate to answer this question, that would be fine as well. But I'm interested in this 1983, I think it's called the Basin Plan for the Columbia River, that sort of established what Washington might do, what we might do, and then they've chosen to exercise more. Is that something that is an ongoing, updated process where this overall mix of allowable withdrawals is going to be reviewed again, or is that sort of a permanent thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, I'm probably not the best person to elucidate on that particular basin plan. I can tell you, though, that in 1993, a number of governors, including Governor Barbara Roberts, reached an informal agreement to curtail further withdrawals. Of course, that was easy for Washington to do because they already had 32% of the water. It was easy for Idaho to do. They already had 52%. We only had 7. We were offering it, so I guess they took the deal. My view is, number one, it's not a deal. Number two, it's a bad deal. Number three, to the extent what we really need is a compact, unless we take more water, the states of Washington and Idaho have absolutely no incentive to seek a compact. What we really need is a tri-quadruple state compact over use of this river. But if you're Washington with 32% of the water, why do you want a compact?
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. DeLorenzo.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. We appreciate your attention and patience and holding this hearing. Truly appreciate it.
The next panel before is John Barley, Bruce Buckmaster,
John DeVoe, and see, I have one more person. It would be Rick George also.
John Barkey.
Okay. Please go in whatever order that you wish to go in and identify yourself for the record. Also, the total time for the panel will be 10 minutes.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Chair, Senator Richard Devlin, and members of the committee. My name is John Barkley. If it was barley, I'd probably be a farmer. I'm chairman of the General Council, as well as a member of the Board of Trustees for the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla Indian Reservation. And our treaty is 1855, not 1856. I'm very honored to be here to testify before you on House Bill 3525, which we have seen maneuvered in this session and landed here in the Ways and Means. The Confederate tribes have worked very hard to characterize the nature of the problem and the negative impacts should this bill emerge from this body. Chairman Anton Minthorn and I last month met directly with irrigators and our county commissioners. In the critical groundwater areas of Umatilla and Morrill counties, and we had offered assistance to those irrigators who have been regulated off of groundwater. We have met more than once with these stakeholders in the basin, which we definitely have mutual and common interest, and certainly a divested interest in seeing that we find some resolution to water issues in the basin. I come back to this body today to say that our conclusion is reinforced that House Bill 3525 is the wrong answer. It mandates a water right for 500,000 acre feet every year, which is a cumulative total of 12.5 million acre feet, which would result in local and regional chaos. Further, and just as important, there is already a local body called the Umatilla County Critical Groundwater Task Force, coordinated by the Umatilla County and comprised of irrigators, tribal members, and other local leaders, that is responsible for developing the solutions necessary to fix the problems. Part of that effort is coming up what they call the 2050 plan, some visionary, far-reaching goals that could help provide sustainability of water resources in the basin. I respectfully request that you allow the task force to complete its work. And it's important to note that that task force has refused to support House Bill 3525. On top of the bill being the wrong answer to the problem of water supply for agriculture and fish, House Bill 3525 is fatally flawed and must be stopped for the following reasons. First, in contrast to Washington's Columbia River legislation and program, House Bill 3525 mandates a water right to pull hundreds of thousands of acre feet out of the Columbia River at the exact time when it would most impact endangered salmon and other fish. Washington's program explicitly prevents this kind of impact of fish. House Bill 3525 is silent on salmon protections. Secondly, this bill seeks to remove as much or more water that is provided for salmon recovery under the Endangered Species Act by the entire state of Idaho. Such an ill-fated move would start a water war in the Columbia Basin. Further, the same water provided by Idaho is required under the recent state federal water rights settlement agreement with the Nez Perce tribe. Stream flows are critically important to salmon and to salmon recovery. Third, House Bill 3525 threatens the past 30 years of cooperation in the Umatilla Basin Project, which led to salmon recovery, Umatilla River stream flow restoration, and a stronger agricultural economy. This bill will throw off course the next steps already underway to build Phase 3 of the Umatilla Basin Project, adjust tribal water rights, and develop, with federal support, new Columbia River water for the basin. House Bill 3525 is wrong about the amounts of water needed. It takes authority away from the local task force appointed to address the problem. It harms salmon, creates an interstate water conflict, and will likely spawn litigation and throw off track 30 years of cooperation that is today aimed at a new federal water supply project for the Umatilla Basin, Columbia Plateau area. And I'd just like to add that in meeting with these proponents on a couple occasions, that they themselves admitted that in this bill, a cost for 500,000 acre feet, in which 300,000 acre feet of that was for to irrigate 100,000 acres of new land, that they admitted themselves that upon looking on a topography map that they virtually couldn't irrigate half of those acres because it's not feasible. We heard from them that it's not real practical to use the 3 to 4 acre feet per acre of water, because for an acre of potatoes that'd be 25 inches of water. So some of the logistics and it's lacking rhyme or reason from what we understand in our discussions and dialogue with those proponents about this bill. And to us it seems to be developing and has developed in a rather hastily manner that is not conducive to a collaborative effort that brings resolution to water issues in the basin.
Mr. Bartley, your panel has about 4 minutes left, so
I'd like to thank you for this opportunity, and certainly thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for this opportunity this morning.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Buckmaster from Astoria. I am a board member of Salmon for All and a founding member of the Coalition of Salmon Communities. I'm honored to be on this panel this morning. Just for the record, we have not or will ever be opposed to utilizing water from the Columbia River. Eyedroppers are a great deal more. We are, however, very concerned and oppose House Bill 3525 because of we are still trying to dig out of the unforeseen consequences of water bills and water usages in the lower river. We support development in upper river communities. We would like to see it done responsibly. The science of salmon has been argued, and there have been any number of experts and papers presented, most recently in the court, the federal court in Portland, where flow was determined to be very important and has been mandated for the last 2 years. We see this happening there. This bill is flawed, and we would hope that these desires to pull the water can be accomplished without endangering the lower river communities who have already been irreparably harmed and are devoting our incomes, our livelihoods, to the saving of the salmon. I know we're short on time, so I'll defer to my colleague.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. Members of the committee, my name is John DeVoe. I'm the executive director of Water Watch of Oregon. I'd just like to make a couple points in the remaining time. This bill is a direct attack on certain state rules that protect salmon and steelhead in the Columbia River, so-called sensitive stock rules. It would require those rules to be repealed. That's unacceptable at this time. I would like to point out that there are different ways to calculate the usage of water between the states in the basin, and we've attached a chart to our testimony prepared by the Columbia Basin Water Transactions Program, which is associated with Bonneville, and it shows total water use by state in the basin. The numbers are quite different than what the OASIS proponents are telling you, and in fact, the math associated with their calculations has never been revealed. It is not transparent, and it is not clear how they came up with the numbers there putting before the committee. I'd also like to point out that in terms of average flows, total volume flows over the course of a year, tell you nothing about the real-time impact of withdrawals on fish in the river. And fish depend on water at certain times of year for certain stages of their life. What's happening at a different time of year really doesn't make any difference. We'd like to point out that there is an existing process to use water from the Columbia. The state of Oregon will tell you that water is available from the Columbia in certain fall and winter months. It's available for storage. The proponents of this bill, however, want a free pass on developing the infrastructure to store that water. So water is currently available from the Columbia. It's simply not available for these purposes at the critical times of year when fish are migrating in the river. Furthermore, if you want to restore aquifers in this region, you can do aquifer recharge projects under the existing state of the law. There's no prohibition on that. The sensitive stock rules would allow aquifer recharge projects. We don't need a water war between the states on the Columbia. We have efforts by Montana and Idaho to send stored water down the river currently to help meet the flow targets set by the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. We have the Snake River Basin Adjudication Settlement, whereby about 500,000 acre-feet of water are being leased in stream from storage projects in Montana and Idaho to be sent down the river for flow augmentation. We don't need a water war right now to upset these delicate negotiations and these efforts to restore salmon. The burden in the Columbia has been on fish for a long time, and the notion that we should once again shift the burden to salmon in the Columbia is not the way we ought to be looking at the problem now. There are tremendous efforts being made to restore salmon and steelhead in the river for the benefit of many parties. Recreational and commercial fishing generate about $4.5 billion of economic activity a year in the basin. Recreational fishing in the basin is one of the fastest growing industries in Oregon in the 21st century. We need to look at those industries, value them appropriately, and make sure that they're here in the future. In conclusion, I'd just like to quote from the Ninth Circuit in April in remanding the biological opinion. Part of the opinion focused rejected the federal government's argument that it need only perform a full analysis of risks posed to listed fish if hydropower operations made the conditions appreciably worse for those fish. In rejecting that focus only on large changes that could impact fish, the court stated, quote, under the federal government's approach, a listed species could be gradually destroyed, so long as each step on the path to destruction is sufficiently modest. This type of slow slide into oblivion is one of the very ills the Endangered Species Act seeks to prevent. And so whether we are talking about large withdrawals or smaller withdrawals, we need to prevent that slow slide into oblivion here for salmon and steelhead on the Columbia. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Ferrari.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Mr. Barkley. Being somewhat familiar with water and irrigation problems in my district, I'm to judge your credibility by your testimony, what you say. You stated earlier it takes 24 inches of water to raise potatoes, to grow potatoes?
Sir, to clarify that, I was merely restating what one of the proponents had conveyed to us, that it was unrealistic to use 3 to 4 acre feet of water per acre in a growing season, because that would amount to 25 inches of water for potatoes, which is way too much water to grow potatoes.
Thank you very much. Thank you for clearing that up.
Thank you.
Any additional questions?
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Ed. The issue I'm struggling with is Washington has different laws. Maybe that only the withdrawal July and August not have anything. I don't know what Idaho's laws are. Why shouldn't Oregon at least have what they have, if not more? We're at the very bottom. Gravity has a huge amount to say about this. How are you going to hold back 200 million acre feet of water? So I'm trying to figure out why should we punish ourselves in Oregon when Washington and Idaho and those folks are really taking very, very huge advantage of the Columbia.
My answer would be, Senator Nelson, that it's not a race to the bottom, and perhaps we should be asking why Washington isn't more protective. Just to follow up, I guess. I mean, we're talking about 200 million acre feet of water. This bill, the amended bill, is only talking about taking out 200,000 acre feet. And that's less than one tenth of 1%. And I think what my whole concept of this is people don't understand how big the Columbia River water is and what benefits it can do for everybody, for fish, for everybody, but we seem like we're overloading it. And that's my concern. That's what I'm hearing in my district.
And if I could, Mr. Nelson, Senator Nelson, we work with the state of Washington and their Department of Ecology Director Jay Manning quite extensively, as well as some of the other governor staff on the Columbia Water Partnership, and being very involved at the staff and attorney levels in seeing that as that the policies and legislation were formulated, we ensure that there was mitigating measures in place to make sure that they offset any potential adverse impacts to fisheries, and made sure that the timing of how and when this water withdrawn certainly minimized those impacts. Regarding the amended version of this in 610 that calls for 200,000 acre feet, in our discussions with those very irrigators, and particularly one that was named, even the logistics of getting water to those proponents with those immediate needs was really not clarified for us, and I don't think was fully thought out by those proponents, because they even realized then that the inner discussions before the county commissioners meeting in Hermiston, they had actually, the number we discussed was down to 20 to 40,000 acre feet of water to meet their immediate needs, not 195,000.
And I just have some articles that I've just gotten. This is from May 27th. Little city of Irrigan is preparing to battle the water department over the fact they don't have any water. Got a letter from the Water Resource Department dated May 25th, 2007, which basically is, if your water right is older than March 28th of 1909, you can still use water. So, I mean, what I'm hearing as elected representatives from all sorts of, you know, my constituents, I mean, there's two different instances where those folks out there are telling me I need water, you know, and they're saying, you know, try and work with people, try and get it. So I just like the community to understand where I'm coming from in this viewpoint.
Yes, Representative Clem, and then we'll have to move on.
Just one, I'd like your reaction to something. I think that, you know, your statement that we don't need a water war, it sort of seems like we already have one, and we're losing it. And it was said in 1983. So let's say you had 100% of the water used, and we wanted to reallocate the percentage, so no additional water is used. We just would like some more from what Washington and Idaho has. So that compact that Mr. DiLorenzo discussed, what's the best strategy for getting into that conversation? Because I can see some would argue this is the best strategy. It will force the conversation. Are there other strategies that, you know, essentially, we're talking about no net loss of water, but a redistribution of the existing water. What would you be willing to participate in to have that conversation?
I would just like to add that, of course, this dilemma is created by the management of the resource itself. When you deplete the water aquifer and that resource, certainly the state has to step in and manage that and shut that off, because you have to find reasonable solutions that are going to alleviate that situation. And I wouldn't say we're in a water war right now. The tribes have been very upfront and very involved with constituents and stakeholders in the basin, as proven with the Umatilla Basin Projects number 1 and 2, in which we could have stepped in and you want to threaten litigation. You know, we chose to negotiate versus litigate. And it was a sound approach for on the benefit of everybody in the basin. And we continue and we aspire to follow through with the way we've done it in the past. We think a collaborative approach to finding resolution in the basin is the sound way to do it. This particular bill does not do that. It's a detraction from that. It only addresses a component of the basin. And in our discussions with stakeholders and our congressional representatives, we want to see resolution that can help address all of our issues in the basin.
I might follow up. I don't mean a water war within the basin. I mean with the other states. I'm not saying that within the basin there isn't those problems aren't talked about in an amicable way. I'm talking about the other states have their share, and I'd like to get into a renegotiation state with them.
Certainly an interstate compact is essential. We find that situation in the Walla Walla system in which we've been able to restore 25 CFS of water in the Walla Walla River and Oregon side, in which the irrigation districts over there have had to make those sacrifices. But once it crosses into Washington, junior users over there are taking it out. And so we're in a similar situation as was conveyed, that we have upstate folks releasing water to meet in-stream flows and to be taken out down here. There needs to be some interstate resolution to what's going on between the states.
I would also add very briefly.
Very briefly, because we have about 15 people left to do in about 28 minutes.
There are historical and geographical reasons why there are different amounts of water taken by the states in the basin. You would be hard-pressed to find any tributary of a river in Idaho that is not tributary to the Columbia. So there are geographic reasons for differences. There are historical settlement pattern differences that account for those reasons. There are land quality reasons that account for those differences. There are a lot of reasons out there why we have different levels. I would also say that the math underlying the charts that you've been given is somewhat suspect, and you should not necessarily treat those numbers as the true situation on the river.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will now move on to panels of three. We only have about 32 minutes left, and I'd like to indicate that anyone that doesn't get a chance to testify, we are more than willing to accept written testimonies. I also indicate that what I'm going to try to do is to have opponents and proponents together. We do not actually have have a little bit of lopsided representation here in terms of testimony, but I'm going to try to just get through this as expeditiously as possible, but still giving everyone a chance to speak, if at all possible. My House members are subject to a call, but we'll get started here. The first will be Steve Eldridge, then Tom Wolf and Jeff Curtis. Will you please come forward? You'll have 2 minutes each, and I'm going to have to be pretty hard on that time to get everybody through in the remaining time we have. No, I don't think so. Please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
My name is Steve Eldridge. I'm the manager of Umatilla Electric Cooperative, a nonprofit electric co-op in Hermiston, Oregon. I was born and raised in the area, and we provide electricity to approximately 3,000 of our members who are affected by this critical groundwater area. The first thing this is my idea. I'll take responsibility for it, because living and growing up in that area, I know what our irrigators can do, and I know the benefit that it has. And we've also been the epicenter of salmon recovery. So the first task was to determine whether or not this water could be taken out without harming salmon. And we looked at rulings by Judge Redden, in which the plaintiffs requested more flows, and he turned them down, acknowledging that the science supporting ever more flows is not there. We looked at a peer-reviewed scientific report by the Independent Science Advisory Board for the Northwest Power Planning Council, who reviewed Montana's plan to change flows by 8,000 cubic feet in July, and their finding was that they could not measure the effect, and therefore by scientific method there was no effect. And since our withdrawal was 900 cubic feet a second, we drew the conclusion that there was not a salmon problem. The next thing we did is to see if there was local support. We went to the tribes first in September. They directed their CEO to meet with us. 2 months later, we met with them. They promised comments. We received none. January, we met with them. They promised comments. We received none. And in February, when the bill finally had to be introduced, then one of the reasons the tribes could not support is a lack of collaboration. I do not understand that statement. Then We went to every community, every city council, every county commission, including the Critical Groundwater Task Force. They all endorsed this bill. The tribes are the only ones that have not. They're the only ones talking about war. No one else is. And I, you know, since it's my bill.
And you can just wrap up in about 1 minute.
Okay, thank you. You know, this is not cumulative. If you want to look at it, 11 million acre feet over 25 years, 4.8 billion acre feet flow by. That's 0.2%. No normal person would say that was adverse. And then the last thing is that I think that if you turn this down, I hope that you require the same kind of substantiation from the opponents of this to show how their findings are, at what they're actually based on. And when the tribes come to you and ask for a water right that's unmitigated for, that you will oppose it as you are opposing this. And lastly, we have met the scientific test, the community test. We have offered to mitigate for every gallon taken out of the river, and it's still not good enough. Why is that?
Thank you. Please proceed. Identify yourself for the record.
Chair Devlin, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I represent the 3,500 members of Trout Unlimited that live here in the state. When I came down here, I was really torn about what I was going to say. Obviously, there's been some people before that have brought before scientific data that shows why this bill should be opposed, and we are opposed to that. But what should I say that would add to that? And first of all, you have to know that I come from a family that is a farming background. Members of my family are farmers all across western Washington County, so I understand the need for water, and I sympathize with the farmers in eastern Oregon. But I think one thing that has been ignored that can be done is would be allowed to be done is to take out winter flows. And there can be money that could probably be appropriated for storage sites. I think that we're ignoring that, whereas summer flows would have a definite impact on salmon and steelhead. If you took out winter flows, say in December, January, February, when there are no salmon going down or coming back, we can take out water and use that. So whereas I sympathize with the needs of this bill, I think that to protect steelhead and salmon, we need to appropriate winter flows and look for ways to store it. Thank you.
Mr. Curtis.
For the record, Chairman Devlin, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Curtis. I'm the Pacific Salmon Director for Trout Unlimited National. We're the national organization of about 150,000 members. I work with Tom, who's the president of the local council of Trout Unlimited. I think the one piece that I might be able to add to this is that I was John DeVoe's predecessor, or one of his predecessors, as the director of Water Watch of Oregon, and I was there when we negotiated. I was on the Rules Advisory Committee when we negotiated the Division 33 rules that we were talking about right now. And I just want to make a point that it really was a negotiation. One of the people on the other side that I remember was Gail Ackerman, who is, those of you who know Gail, she's a tough negotiator. And we spent a long time on these rules. And the result is, frankly, a compromise. And it was a compromise that people accepted at the time. And I think it is often said that environmentalist conservationists never seem to have enough. You know, we always come back and ask for more. And I just think that this is one of those situations where we worked out something, we came to an agreement, and now the other side, the people who want to take more water out of the river, have come back and asked for more. And I think that we should kind of recall that people who work on these things in the past and struggle through these things deserve some consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you all. We'll move on to our next panel. Ms. Fast, if you're here. Mr. Glenn Spain and Liz Franco. And please, if you could all limit yourself to 2 minutes, it would be most appreciated.
Good Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with Oregon Farm Bureau. Oregon Farm Bureau Federation supports House Bill 3525 and the Dash 4 amendments, which are significantly reducing the amount of water requested to be taken out of the Columbia River. This retains the economic opportunities of the Umatilla Basin. This is an area struggling to stay afloat in a critical groundwater area. The farmers have done the maximum amount possible through conservation and now are being regulated off their water rights. And I think you've heard testimony on kind of the economic impacts that we're seeing in the area. And you're also hearing comments of winter flow and storage opportunities in the area. And Farm Bureau is extremely supportive, as I think you all know, of looking at storage opportunities in the state and seeing the state make an investment in those. However, storage in the Umatilla Basin is decades away, and it's going to take years of planning, permitting, and construction to get that done. And as we've been looking and having discussions with looking at this amount of water states are taking out of other areas, I think we should also look at what other areas are doing in storage as well. And recently, through the Columbia River Water Management Plan in Washington, the Washington legislature is devoting about $220 million in general fund and bonding opportunities for storage in the Columbia River on the Washington side. Oregon is not making those investments. Oregon is investing about $900,000 this session on looking at storage statewide. For storage to work, we need to have investment in the storage in the state. But in the same time, we need to keep the farmers in the Umatilla Basin afloat and have withdrawals through the Columbia on a short-term basis, which what the Oasis Project allows. So keep those farmers in business so those storage opportunities are there for them in the future. And with that, I'll conclude and happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Spain. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for the largest trade association in the commercial fishing industry in the West Coast, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations. We represent over 2,000 fishing, family fishing operations, which are small businesses up and down the coast, many in Oregon, many in Washington, directly affected by what happens in the Columbia. I want to emphasize that there is no free water. Water taken out of the Columbia comes from some other industry and some other water user, primarily the fishing industry. I've heard it said by the proponents of the bill, the water is just sitting there in the river ready for development. It is sitting there protecting a major industry and a major component of our economy, which is the fishing industry. There are tens of millions of fish that come through that system every year. This is the largest salmon producing river in the world. It is the vast majority, provides the vast majority of all the salmon that are harvested all the way down to Northern California and all the way up to Southeast Alaska. It is a billion-dollar industry based on a river system that is already severely over-appropriated. And particularly in the summer, there have been some fallacious statistics. You know, it's lies, damn lies, and statistics. One of the tricks on the other side, frankly, is they take the whole annual, including annual flow of the river, including winter rains and winter flood flows. The key issue is how much water is in the river during the summer when the salmon are running. Some 40% of the river has already been taken. This would add to that burden and add to a burden that, by the way, the National Academy of Sciences, who looked at this very issue in the context of Washington and a proposal to take less than half of the amount of water proposed in this bill out of the river in Washington, concluded that amount would pose unacceptable risks to the salmon industry, of which right now there are over a dozen salmon listed under the ESA. And a tremendous amount of effort and money has gone into recovering that extremely valuable economic resource. We're very sympathetic to farmers and their need for water. We are farmers of the sea. We provide food products to folks just as they do for people's table. But we need water in the river, and our industry is based on that premise.
If you could please.
We would support any efforts to provide additional storage. Certainly water conservation is a viable option. And but we can't allow a water grab of this magnitude because of the impact it would have on our industry. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Frankel.
Ms. Frankel, League of Women Voters. We've testified before on this bill. We do oppose it, probably for many of the reasons that you've heard here, but also our concern about what it does for water law and the way in which rules are implemented. And this is of concern to us. I will be handing in a written testimony on this. I can't help but add another comment, and I'm reminded about, we've all heard about the tragedy of Commons, and this is where everybody began to use it, and then suddenly there was no Commons. And one of the things you always have to remember is that what you do today is only what happens today. There's the future. And when you start allocating water, the risks that you hear now, it's hard to know just exactly what the future is going to bring, because this is not the end of people needing and wanting water. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll next go on to our next panel, which will be Mr. Fluting. Come forward. Bill Fluting, if you come forward. Jeremiah Bauman and Charles Hudson.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. Committee for the record, Bill Fluting, Carpenters Industrial Councils. We'll hear from experts on both sides. What I'm here to talk to you about is if this bill would go forward, I see industrial jobs. Oregon needs industrial jobs. We have the workforce available to build the ethanol producing plants if this could possibly produce. We have the manpower to run these facilities 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Economic studies will show you that creating 16 jobs in one of these rural areas is like creating 14,000 jobs in the city of Portland. That's the economic benefit for these smaller areas. Right now, presently, this country is buying 50% of OPEC's oil. The country of Iran is producing 60% of OPEC's oil. Whatever ethanol we can produce in this country could stop funding one of the terrorist states in this world. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeremiah Bauman with Environment Oregon, the new organizational home of Osberg's environmental work. Environment Oregon strongly urges the committee's opposition to House Bill 3525. Very briefly, the Columbia River is obviously an icon of Oregon in the Northwest. It's critical to many industries in our region. It's also it's the center point of the battleground in terms of litigation. As you've heard today, all sorts of regional task forces, compacts, management plans, a tangled web really of policies and agreements trying to balance the benefits for the region both between states and between various industry sectors in those states. My main points for you today are two. First, the proponents of the bill have argued that there is no science saying that there would be a risk to salmon, and that's just simply not the case. There are, in fact, decades of scientific work that have been done because of the massive federal and state and regional investment in trying to recover the salmon populations. To quote from the same National Academy of Sciences referenced by Mr. Spain, the National Academy of Sciences said, allowing for additional water withdrawals during critical periods of high demand, low flows, and comparatively high water temperatures, in summer, time, would increase risks of survivability to listed salmon stocks and reduce management flexibility. There's a significant risk here, and that's my second point, that this strategy is a very, very high-risk strategy for a step forward in the middle of all these tensions. I don't know what the best way to get to an interstate water compact is, but I would propose that Oregon simply withdrawing a massive amount of water is a very dangerous way to try to get in that direction, specifically because we've got billions of dollars at stake, not only that Oregon ratepayers have already invested in trying to recover our salmon stocks, but billions of dollars in Oregon's current fishing industry. The significant economic consequences of the climate situation and the federal government's restriction on fishing last summer there would only be worse if the same were to happen in the Columbia, which is one possible consequence of engaging in this kind of significant water withdrawal without the years of planning required and that have been invested in other decisions of this scope. Thank you.
Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Charles Hudson. I'm the Public Information Director for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. Chair Devlin and members of the subcommittee, thank you for allowing us to testify. The commission's member tribes include the Yakima Nation, the Nez Perce Tribe of Idaho, the Warm Springs Tribe of Oregon, and the Umatilla Tribe of Oregon, who you heard from earlier. We have prepared some written testimony and have submitted that to you that includes a detailed critique of House Bill 3525, as well as some of the statutory authorities and activities of our four member tribes in our effort to recover salmon and other species. I will be summarize that testimony in three primary areas. And again, we are here in opposition of House Bill 3525. Additional water withdrawals can increase travel time for fish, leading to decreased survival. An analysis by tribal, state, and federal fishery agencies indicates that withdrawals under the Oasis Project will increase fish travel time through the lower Columbia River, causing a substantial reduction in smolt-to-adult returns. In low-flow years, fish travel time would increase over 14 days, decreasing first-year ocean survival by an estimated 9% and smolt-to-adult returns by an estimated 2.7%. This is going the wrong direction with respect to recovering endangered salmon. Less water in the system can compound the effects of heating, causing water temperatures to rise faster and stay warmer longer. This results in increased predation rates on salmon and Pacific lamprey, loss of the ability for smolts to transition to salt water, and increased rates of adult pre-spawning mortality and loss of, adult gamete viability. Again, the Nez Perce Tribe is one of our member tribes. As part of their water settlement, formerly known as the Snake River Water Rights Act of 2004, the Bureau of Reclamation will release up to 427,000 acre-feet annually of flow augmentation water from upper Snake River reservoirs to aid the migration of juvenile salmonids in the lower Snake River. Also as part of the settlement, the Bureau of Reclamation acquired 60,000 acre-feet of natural flow rights in the upper Snake River for flow augmentation, which when combined with the 427 calf equals 487 calf of upper Snake water. The Nez Perce Tribe does not want the benefits of this flow augmentation to be negated by the Oasis withdrawals.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Mr. Helgeson, Mr. Karskadon, and Brent Foster. Colleagues, we will have one panel after this. Please identify yourself and please limit yourself to 2 minutes each.
I'll try to do better than that, Chair. My name's Trey Karskadon. I hail from Tualatin, lifelong Oregonian. I represent the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association, more than their 300 member businesses. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing us to testify today in opposition of House Bill 3525. Let me first say that the sport fishing industry has no bone to pick with agriculture. You know, we clearly understand the need for water. It's something that we fought for decades for these fish. The court's been very clear recently and mandated on several levels putting water back in the river to aid sensitive species that make their way to Idaho. Just recently, and I don't understand the testimony that I've heard today, the federal government mandated 427,000 acre-feet of water be put back in the river by Idaho, Montana, just this year. And my reading of the Washington Water Plan is quite different than what I've heard as well, which mandates that when one bucket is taken, two are put back. Maybe I've read that incorrectly, but at least in our reading of it, it appears to be more of a conservation measure than just a grab. We have, between 1990 and 2000, we saw the decline of 10,000 jobs regionally in the regional sport fishing industry. Significant declines. In 2001, 2002, we got some of that back as a result of flow and spill. Something of this magnitude, whether it's 500,000 acre-feet or 200,000 acre-feet, doesn't feel like an eyedropper to us. It feels like a lot of water to be extracting from this river. And it doesn't feel like it's going to be of any benefit to fish. So we ask that you oppose this. We thank you so much for your service to the state and for your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Devlin, members of the committee. My name is Les Helgeson. I'm here representing the Native Fish Society. I hope you've received some temperature studies we provided you by email sent by our executive director, Bill Bakke. It clearly is an issue on the Columbia. It's a very complex area, and it's been a lot of excellent testimony here today. It's going to be tough to add anything to it, so I'll keep this very brief. I do have a couple of concerns, one being there's no study showing harm, I think was a statement made here, and I think the methodology that was used, so maybe analogy would be that I went out and operated a barge on the Columbia River without an operator's license. You know, some of this methodology is very complex. You need to know how to use it. And I don't see NOAA Fisheries here supporting the use of their methodology to back up what the proponents are claiming here. And the agricultural benefits, sure, that's tough to argue with, values of peas and potatoes and so forth versus dry land wheat. But I'd ask you to weigh the benefits of a restored Columbia River fishery, or fisheries to be more correct. And I think you get a little more accurate picture of what we're looking at in the long term here. And with that, I think I'll conclude my testimony with some concerns. It's sounding like this may be a water grab. I've heard the word biofuel, ethanol, and so forth one too many time. And I think biofuels are kind of a trend at this time, but there have been studies, it's been published in the press as well, that the biofuels may actually be more toxic to us and to the environment than burning gasoline. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
I'm going to have to keep that in mind on my drive home in my biodiesel. But my name is Brent Foster. I'm the executive director for Columbia Riverkeeper. Chair Devlin and members of the committee, appreciate the chance to testify. I think the idea of making the desert bloom into an oasis is certainly not a new idea. It's got a certain romantic appeal to it, and I would give a big award to whoever decided to call this the Oasis Project. They earned their PR dollars, because it even makes me kind of get a little warm and fuzzy. I live in a dry area of Wasco County. It's a critical groundwater area. My neighbor's wells went dry last summer. I wonder each summer if my well will go dry. So I can appreciate the need and the fear about running out of water. I was filling up my fire tanks last week. I was very happy when they reached their peak and there was still water. But I don't think that's what this bill is about. I think that this bill is about opening up another 100,000 acres, at least opening up the door to that. And to me, from the perspective of the river, we've already asked the river to do way too much. Salmon are at risk. We know multiple runs have gone extinct. I work a lot in around Astoria. I know many salmon fishermen who had to, when they curtailed salmon fishing, go essentially to on the public dole to feed their families. And, you know, tribal fishing has similarly been curtailed. Certainly understand the desire to create more jobs in eastern Oregon. It's where my dad was raised and grandmother was raised in Bend and ranched. But at the same time, adding jobs that cost salmon jobs doesn't produce a net benefit, and that's something to consider. Columbia is really a victim of death by a thousand cuts, and this, in my mind, would be yet another cut. If we want there to be salmon in 20 years, there is a monumental task of cooling the Columbia River and increasing its flow from what's there now. And were there not over 300 dams, were there not already major water withdrawals, were there not already major habitat alterations, then I think we could say, sure, what's another 500,000, another 100,000, et cetera, acre feet. But that's not the situation we're at. So thank you for your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
And now, Mr. Hunt, if you'll come forward, and Ivan Maluski, and you'll be our final testimony for today. And if you'll limit yourself to 2 minutes each, I will only be 2 minutes over.
You did a great job, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Chair Devlin and committee. My name is Doug Hunt. I'm the Volunteer Resource Director for the Northwest Steelheaders. We have 17 chapters around the state and over 2,000 members. Our priorities are to advance fishing opportunity, improve salmon and steelhead habitat for future generations. Fishing is an important part of the Oregon culture and heritage. Oregon's made tremendous investments in salmon recovery. We passed Measure 66 to provide a dedicated source of revenue to fund salmon restoration projects. We've made significant management choices to curtail sport and commercial harvest. Our association leaderships considered House Bill 3525 and concluded that the risks outweigh the benefits. We're opposed to withdrawing 500,000 acres of feet of water, which I've seen as 5,000 football fields covered 100 feet deep annually. This is an important period when the salmon and steelhead smolts are migrating from the ocean and should not compromise the journey. Furthermore, this bill circumvents the state rules were created to protect threatened and endangered fish. It exempts a small group of users from any future fees for water. No other water right holder in the state enjoys this exemption. And it circumvents the state's water allocation policies that were created to protect other water uses. Please oppose passage of House Bill 3525. Thank you for your consideration.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, I'll be brief to respect your time. For the record, my name is Ivan Maluski, and I'm the Conservation Coordinator for the Oregon Chapter Sierra Club. I won't repeat a lot of the comments that have been made earlier today. We support some of what the information that Water Watch, Environment Oregon, Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association have all brought to bear today. I think that's really helpful. I think it's important to note that we are opposed to House Bill 3525. It circumvents existing rules for fisheries protections. The Columbia River is already in a state of crisis in terms of hot water that's out there for fish. I would disagree with the statement that that water is just waiting to be used out there. In fact, the water in the river is being used for a lot of different purposes, including for hydroelectric dams in the Columbia. This type of bill could upset some of the delicate issues around the operation of those dams as well. So this, in the end, this bill really ignores some of the significant contributions, economic contributions that the fisheries industries makes to the state, as well as our obligations under the 1855 treaty to help maintain salmon runs and work with some of the tribes in the region. So again, we urge you to oppose the bill, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you both. Colleagues, members of the audience, this will conclude our hearing.
What I would want to put on the record is that we've tried to keep this as balanced as possible. I'm sure Senator Nelson would probably tell me, and he probably would be right, that if we were to hold this in his district, there might be more testimony in favor. And we're here in the middle of the Willamette Valley. But with that, I want to appreciate everyone coming here today, appreciate you all being very courteous in your testimony, and that will conclude our public hearing. And members of the committee, watch our agenda for tomorrow because there's going to be probably a number of additions to that agenda. So, and with that, we'll conclude.